Chapter 16. At 1 in the afternoon, his wife was to pick him up at the front entrance of the hospital and drive him home. But the night before, he telephoned Bill Jaffers, the shop foreman at his plant in Petaluma, and told him to come by the hospital with a pickup truck at 9 in the morning. He explained to Jaffers that his wife was too nervous to take the responsibility of driving him home. So at 8:30 he got out of his hospital bed, put on his clothes, his tie and white shirt and suit and shined black Oxfords, made sure he had all his possessions in his suitcase, paid his bill at the business office of the hospital, and then sat outside on the steps waiting for Jaffers. The day was cool and bright, with no fog. Finally, the plant's pickup truck appeared and parked. Jaffers, a big, dark-haired man in his early 30s, stepped out and up to Charlie Hume.
"Hey, you're looking almost well," he said.
He began picking up the pile of possessions stacked beside Charlie and putting them into the bed of the truck.
"I feel okay,"
Charlie said, standing up. He felt weak and sick to his stomach, and he waited for Jaffers to help him into the cab. Soon they were driving through downtown San Francisco, toward the Golden Gate Bridge. As always, traffic was heavy.
"Take your time," he told Jaffers.
As he figured it, Faye would leave the house about 11. He did not want to get there before she left, so that gave them 2 hours.
"Don't go terrassing around curves like you do when you're on company time, wearing out rubber that doesn't cost you anything to replace."
He felt despondent and leaned against the door to gaze out at the cars and houses and streets.
"Anyhow, I have to stop along the way and buy some things," he said.
"What do you have to get?"
Jaffer said.
"None of your business," Charlie said. "I'll get it."
Sometime later, they parked in the shopping district of one of the suburban Marin towns. Leaving Jaffers, he got out of the truck and walked down the street and around the corner to a large hardware store that he knew. There he bought a .22 revolver and 2 cartons of bullets. At home he had a number of guns, both rifles and pistols, but beyond any doubt, Faye would have gotten them hidden. He had the clerk wrap the revolver and ammunition in such a way that no one could tell what it might be, and then he paid cash and left the store. Presently he was back in the truck with the parcel on his lap. As they drove on, Jaffers said,
"Bet that's for your wife."
"You're not kidding,"
Charlie said.
"That's quite some wife you have,"
Jaffers said.
Charlie said,
"You're not just a whistling Dixie."
In Fairfax, they stopped at a drive-in and had something to eat. Jaffers ate 2 hamburgers and a vanilla milkshake, but he himself had only a bowl of soup. As they drove up the Sir Francis Drake Highway, through the park, Jaffers said,
"This is sure beautiful country. We used to come up here all the time, up around Inverness, and fish. We used to catch salmon and bass."
He went on to describe the fishing equipment that he liked. Charlie half listened.
"So the way I feel about spinners," Jaffers concluded, "is that it's fine for, say, surf fishing, but for stream fishing, I don't see the use. And Jesus, the good ones can cost you $95 just for the spinner alone."
"That's for sure," Charlie murmured.
The time, when they reached Drake's Landing, was 11:10. She must have left, he decided. But as the truck reached the cypress lane that preceded his house, he saw between the trees the flash of sunlight on the hood of the Buick. "God damn her," he thought. She had not left.
"Go on by," he said to Jaffers.
"What do you mean?"
Jaffers said, slowing the truck and starting to turn into the driveway. With ferocity, he said,
"Keep going, you fink! Keep driving! Don't go in the driveway!"
Bewildered, Jaffers brought the truck back onto the road and kept on. Peering back, Charlie saw the front door of the house standing open. Evidently, she was almost ready to leave.
"I don't get it," Jaffers said.
He had apparently put together the sight of the Buick in the driveway and Charlie's desire to go on and not stop.
"Doesn't she know I picked you up? Christ's sake, don't you want to stop her before she leaves?" "You mind your business or you're fired," Charlie said. "You want to be out of a job? So help me God, I'll fire you. I'll write you out 2 weeks' notice right now."
"Okay," Jaffers said.
But it's a hell of a thing to let her drive all the way down to Frisco and all the way back for nothing.
He became moodily silent, continuing to drive.
Park here, Charlie said, when they reached the top of a rise. Get over on the shoulder. No, turn the truck around.
They parked in such a way that he could see down the road as far as Inverness Park. When the Buick left the driveway, he would see it take off.
Can I smoke? Jaffers said.
Sure,
he said.
15 minutes later, the Buick appeared on the road and shot off in the direction of Highway 1.
There she goes, he said. Okay, he said. Let's get back. I feel tired. Come on, let's go.
This time they found the driveway empty. Jaffers parked the truck and began carrying Charlie's possessions into the house.
I hope she didn't forget anything, Charlie thought. Doesn't turn around and come back.
He got out of the cab and, with Jaffers supporting him, walked up the path and into the house. There, in the living room, he lowered himself onto the couch.
Thanks, he said to Jaffers. Now you can take off.
You want to go to bed, don't you?
Jaffers said, lingering.
No, he said. I don't want to go to bed. If I wanted to go to bed, I'd be in bed now. I want to sit here. You can leave.
After hanging around a little longer, Jaffers at last left. Seated on the couch, Charlie heard the truck back out of the driveway and go off down the road. Beyond doubt, he had all the time in the world. She would not get to the UC hospital until 1, and then it would take her 2 more hours to get back, so he had until 3 o'clock. He did not have to hurry. He could rest and recover his strength. He could even take a nap. Lifting his feet up onto the couch, he lay back with his head on a pillow. Then he turned on his side to look out the window at the pasture. There, as big as life, stood his horse, cropping weeds. And beyond the horse, he saw one of the sheep. Near the sheep lay a small, dark shape that occasionally stirred. My God, he thought, a lamb. That ewe's had a lamb. He tried to make out the other sheep, to see if they had had their lambs too. But he could see only this one. It looked to be Alice, the oldest of the three. That's a fine old ewe, he thought to himself, watching her. Almost 8 years old and wise as hell. Smarter than some humans. He watched another ewe approach her, and her lamb ambled toward it. The other ewe butted the lamb back to its own mother, and that gave him a charge. You'd think a blow like that would break it in half, he thought. But it doesn't. She has to butt it. Needs her own milk for her own lambs. Big, wise, old, black-faced sheep. He recalled the girls feeding Alice by hand, the great, tranquil, intelligent face, as the ewe bent to push its muzzle against their flat palms. Don't curl your fingers, he told them, like when you feed the horse. Don't stick up anything for her to nip off. They really have strength in those jaws. Grind the grass like rotary blades. Bone rototillers. And good for a hell of a lot longer than that monkey Ward's piece of tin. He thought suddenly, of course. When she gets to the hospital and finds me gone, she could call Aunt Teal and send him right over here. That would be approximately 1 o'clock. So maybe I don't have so much time after all. Getting up from the couch, he stood for a moment. God, I'm weak, he thought. Wow. Unsteadily, he walked from the living room into the bathroom. There, with the door shut, he opened his parcel. He seated himself on the toilet seat and loaded the gun. Carrying the gun in the pocket of his coat, he went outdoors, onto the patio. The day had become warm and the sun made him feel stronger. He walked to the fence, opened the gate, and stepped out onto the pasture. The horse, seeing him, started in his direction.
Thinks I have something for him to eat, he thought. Sugar cube.
The horse picked up speed, jogging toward him and blowing excitedly.
Oh, dear God, he thought as the horse stopped a few feet away from him, eyeing him. How can I? The fucking horse. If they're so smart, why doesn't it run off?
He got out the revolver and released the safety catch.
Better the horse first, he decided.
lifting the revolver. His hand was shaking wildly. He aimed at the horse's head and compressed the trigger. There was no recoil, but the sound made him tremble. The horse shook his head, pawed, and then turned and galloped off. "I missed him," he thought. "I fired right at him and missed him." But the horse suddenly fell forward as it ran. It pitched over, tumbled, and lay on its side with its legs twitching. The horse screamed. Charlie stood where he was, looking at it. Then he shot it again from a distance. The horse continued to kick, and he started toward it to fire again at close range. But by the time he reached it, it had stopped kicking. It was still alive, he could tell by its eyes. But it was dying. Blood ran down its head from the wound in its skull. In the pasture, the three ewes watched. He walked toward the first one. For a while, it did not budge. He had gotten almost up to it before, as always, it ducked its head and began trotting off, its wide sides sticking out like packs. This one had not had its lambs. He raised the pistol and shot at it. The ewe bucked and picked up speed. It turned slightly to one side erratically. Catching sight of its head, he shot at that. The sheep fell head over heels, its legs flopping. With less trouble, he approached the second ewe. She had been lying down, and as he reached her, she scrambled to her feet. He managed to shoot her before she had gotten entirely up. Her weight, the weight of unborn lambs, held her back. Now he had the trouble of the oldest ewe, with her lamb. He knew that she would not run because she was accustomed to having him approach her. He walked toward her, and she did not stir. She kept her eyes fixed on him. When he was still a few yards off, she bleated loudly. The lamb let out its thin, metallic cry. "What about the lamb?" he asked himself. He hadn't considered that. "Well, it has to be included," he decided, "even though I never saw it before. It's as much mine as any of them." He raised the revolver and shot at the ewe, but by now he had run out of bullets. The hammer only clicked. Standing there, he reloaded the revolver. Far off, the eucalyptus trees stirred with the midday wind. The ewe and lamb watched him and waited as he finished loading the gun and put the box of bullets away. Then he took aim and shot the ewe. It sank down on its knees and keeled over. At once he shot the lamb before it could start making any racket. Like its mother, it died soundlessly, and that made him feel better. He walked slowly back toward the house, conserving his strength. On the pasture, nothing stood upright. No shapes of cropping animals. He had swept it clean. Where, he wondered, was the dog? Has she taken it with her? That made him angry. He passed through the house and out onto the front porch. Sometimes the dog spent its time down the street or across the street. Using the dog whistle on his keychain, he called it. Finally, a muffled bark sounded somewhere in the house. She had shut the dog in, probably in one of the bedrooms. Sure enough, he found the collie standing in the guest bedroom, wagging its tail happily to see him. He led the dog outdoors onto the patio and shot it by putting the muzzle of the gun against its ear. The dog let out a screech, like a mechanical brake, so high-pitched that he scarcely could hear it. It leaped up and spun and fell down, scrabbling. Next, he walked down to the duck pen. While he was busy shooting the ducks through the wire mesh, he thought, "Won't somebody hear all the gunshots and call Sheriff Chisholm?" "No," he decided. "There's always hunters this time of year, bagging quail or rabbits or deer, whatever's in season." Having finished with the ducks, he searched about for the chickens. The flock had gone off somewhere, and he saw no sign of it. "Damn them," he thought. He called them, using the sound that he and Faye made at feeding time, but no chickens appeared. Once he thought he saw a red tail moving in the cypress thickets. Possibly the chickens had gone up into the cypress trees and had roosted there, watching him. No doubt the noise of the shooting had sent them packing. Bantams, he thought. So damn crafty. There was nothing left to shoot, so he returned to the house. The business of shooting the animals had put him in a state of exhaustion. As soon as he had gotten into the house, he shed his coat, threw the gun down, dropped down onto the couch, and lay on his back with his eyes shut. His heart surely was going to stop working entirely. He could feel it preparing to cease beating. "God damn it," he prayed. "Keep going, you motherfucker." After a time, he felt better, but he did not move. He continued to lie dormant, conserving himself. "Maybe 2 hours," he thought. "By then, I'll either be dead or strong enough to get back on my feet." From outdoors, beyond the patio, he heard a sound suggesting that one of the animals was not entirely dead. He heard whimpers, but although he listened, he could not make out which animal it was. "Probably the horse," he concluded. Should he go out and shoot it again? Of course. But could he? "No," he decided. "I can't. I'd fall over dead either going or coming. It'll have to die by itself." He lay on the couch, listening to the faint sounds of the animal out on the pasture dying, and meanwhile, trying not to die himself. All at once, the noise of a car engine woke him. He slid his feet to the floor and arose, his heart pounding. He reached around him for the gun and could not find it. Outdoors, beyond the windows, Faye appeared on the patio. In her long green coat, she stood gazing off across the field, and then she stood on tiptoe, shading her eyes. She's seen the animals, he realized. Her crying was audible to him. She turned, saw him through the windows. "Goddamn gun," he thought. He still could not find it where he had put it. Faye had an armload, her purse and some packages. She dropped them and ran on high heels to the gate. At the gate, she had trouble. She could not get the latch undone. He ran across the room and pushed open the door to the patio. By the barbecue pit, standing upright, was the long two-pronged fork that they used to lift the broiling steaks. He grabbed that and hurried toward her. Now she had gotten the gate open. On the far side, she paused to kick off her shoes. Her eyes were filled with wariness. When he had gotten almost to her, she loped away, facing him, not taking her eyes from him. If I had the gun, he realized, she'd be dead now. He reached the fence and passed on through the open gate, onto the field. Faye, not speaking to him but speaking past him, called in a sharp, loud voice, "You stay there!" The kids, he realized. Half turning his head, he saw them, standing together at the corner house, both dressed up in their red coats and nice lace-edged skirts, two-tone shoes, their hair brushed, staring at him, staring and staring, neither of them crying. Backing away from him, Faye called to the children, "Go on away! Go up the road to Mrs. Silver's! Go on!" Her voice got that commanding tone, that harshness. Both children at once jumped forward, toward her, automatically going to her. "Go on up to Mrs. Silver's," Faye called to them, gesturing toward the road. This time the children understood. They disappeared around the corner of the house. He faced his wife. "Oh," she said, almost with delight. Her face shone. "I see. You shot them." She had backed to the dead horse and had cast a quick glance. "Well," she said, "my goodness." He continued a few more steps toward her. She moved back the same distance. The distance did not change. "You motherfucker," she said. "You daughter fucker. You father fucker. You turd face. You shithead. You—" She went on steadily, never taking her eyes from him. She kept herself under control by cursing at him, and he kept on advancing toward her. Of course, she retreated equally, with her wariness. "Call me anything you want," he said. "I'll tell you what I'll call," she said. "I'll call Sheriff Chisholm and have you put in jail. I'll get the police here. I'll get you sent away. You nut, you madman, you sick person." Back and back she went, never letting him get closer than 10 feet from her. Now she had gotten her wind back. He saw her twist her head, measuring her distance from the barbed wire fence behind her that marked the edge of their land. Beyond the fence, the ground sloped sharply, into trees and shrubs, and eventually to marshy ground and a fast-moving stream. Once, he and she had pursued the Muscovy duck down onto the marshes. The duck had taken refuge among the roots of willows, and it had taken them all day to close in on her. His feet at the time had sunk down 6 inches with each step. "I haven't got it," he said to himself. Now she was moving more quickly. She was getting ready to leap the fence, like an animal. Eyeing it first, being sure, one hop and over, and then off at the speed of light. But still she retreated step by step. She was not near enough to the fence to turn her back to him. He began to hasten. "Ah," she said with excitement, and at once she turned and leaped the fence. Her body spun and she was on the far side, still spinning, getting her balance. She fell to her knees, splashing in the mud and cow flop. At once she was up and off. "Shows me her heels," he thought, going onto the fence himself and stooping down to crawl between the wire. It took him a long, long time to get across, and on the far side he could scarcely stand upright. There, not 10 feet away, she stood watching him. "Why?" he wondered. "Why didn't she run off?" Again he approached her, holding the long fork toward her. She resumed her slow backward walk. "Why?" he asked himself again as she slipped a little on the wet slope. And then he realized why. The children and the Silvas stood in the land behind the Silvas' house watching. 4 people, and now a fifth, an elderly man, joined them. He understood. She wants them to see. "God," he thought, "she's making them see me. She'll never run, never get away. She wants me to keep on, all the proof, here. Here I am, out in the field, pursuing her with this fork." Realizing that, he waved the fork at her. "God damn you," he yelled at her. She smiled her quick, reflexive smile. "I'll kill you," he shouted. She backed away, step by step. He turned and started toward the house. She remained where she was, not going any farther away and not following him. At last he reached the fence again. He crept between the wire and into his own field. "We were on the Brackett's property," he realized. "She still is. Standing on Bob Brackett's field, his 40 acres of swamp that we had an option on once and then let go." When he got to the patio, he looked back. 3 men, starting from one of the houses up the road, were coming steadily toward him across the Brackett's field. Fay hung back beyond them. Opening the back door, he crept into the house. He locked the door after him and threw down the barbecue fork. "And the dead animals," he realized. "Proof. All that dead stuff out there. And everybody heard me say it. The doctor and Teal. The kids saw me hit her that day. Hell, they all know." On the floor by the couch, he found the gun. He picked it up and stood holding it, meditating. Then he seated himself on the couch. The men had halted by the fence. They could see him through the windows, sitting on the couch with the gun. He saw Sheriff Chisholm with them, telling them to go back. Sheriff Chisholm passed by the side of the house and was gone from sight. "He'll get me in 2 shakes of a lamb's tail," he thought. "He knows his business. Fucking rustic farmers." Putting the muzzle of the gun into his mouth, he pulled the trigger. A light came on, instead of sound. He saw, for the first time. He saw it all. He saw how she had moved him, put him up to this. "I see," he said. "Yes, I see." Dying, he understood it all.